Ars Electronica 2009 Human Nature Podcast.
Okay, welcome back to the Ars Electronica Interactive Arts Prize. We're looking now at the two honorary mentions. We've seen the Golden Nika as part of the Human Nature session that we just finished. So we have two presentations, two opportunities to ask the artists about their work. We have Osman Khan and Kim Beck. Kim Beck, Osman Khan, and the wonderfully entitled When Laughter Trips at the Threshold of the Divine, which is a great title. Well done. And then we have Jens Wunderling and his Twitter piece, Default to Public. I'm just going to take a couple of minutes to talk about the jury's deliberations and to try to justify the decisions that we made. We had more than 400 entries for a category which defies definition, and we had 3 days to come up with our decisions. Let's just start with a name. Let's take those two words, interactive and art, one at a time. Interactivity these days is so ubiquitous in our lives, it's almost vanished into the background. It's something ordinary, banal. And as for art, we find that relational art, relational aesthetics, the privileging of sociability, the to and fro of conversation as a aesthetic strategy is now the new international orthodoxy and has been for several years. So what makes interactive art special and distinctive anymore? And what of the third term, the elephant in the room, electronica? Can this idea of electronics and technology help us understand interactive art? Can we speak of media art at all anymore? Well, we didn't have any answers to these questions, but these were the questions which framed our responses to a great number of heterogeneous submissions, veering from the techie to the arty, from social experiments to personal statements, from the convivial to the confrontational. One thing was clear, though, that artists working with technology have become increasingly aware of their shared involvement within the broad sweep of contemporary art discourse, as well as that of consumer and gaming technology, as a critical force for envisioning alternative perspectives, expanding human experience, and challenging reified notions of life and play. So we decided that instead of prescribing a set of criteria, we would look at the effectiveness of the work's vision and of its execution, its relevance within the landscape of contemporary art discourse. And we hope to honor a new kind of engaging and inspiring art form, one that's relevant to current social, technological, and cultural challenges. The three top awards, the Golden Nika and the two awards of distinction, were very different, but all had a distinctively different sensibility. Strong artistic visions with elegant formal strategies that maximize an expressiveness achieved through the minimal use of technology. And this was very important for us, to honor works which use technology in a minimal but extremely appropriate way. You're starting, aren't you? Yeah, so we're going to start with Kim and Osman, When Laughter Trips at the Threshold of the Divine. This is an interactive sculpture. Its functionality and the interactive part is very simple, and it's something which we've all experienced. It's a sliding automatic door, a supermarket door, which opens when you approach it and closes when you walk through. Something which is absolutely ubiquitous and kind of invisible in our daily lives. What makes this a rich and exciting experience is the context. These doors are placed in the middle of a public park. So this object, this experience, is completely decontextualized, and thus a kind of reflection on our everyday experience is created, a reinterpretation, a reconsideration. The work is very well achieved, it's very clean, it's very minimal, and the aesthetics are reminiscent of the kinds of things that Dan Graham used to do. It's about subverting and changing the way we look at public space and public use. It reflects on our society of inclusion and exclusion, of consumerism, and raises important questions about the meaning of public space. So, when laughter trips at threshold of the divine, by Osman Khan and Kim Beck. Thank you.
We'd like to start by thanking Ars Electronica, members of the jury, and the Yoka Center for having us.
We're going to spend a few minutes introducing our work by first talking a little bit about the nature of this collaboration. This is the first project on which we've collaborated, and we each come from very different backgrounds in terms of our work, so we thought it would be useful to give you a little bit of a sense of where we're coming from. As well as talk about some of the ideas that we had while we were developing the piece, and then finally to actually talk about the piece.
So most of my work revolves around creating constructed experiences that take a critical reflection on the everyday. And I'm going to just run through a few projects very quickly. The first one is Sur la table. Here, food objects are placed on a table and bleed their color down, allowing for a tension to be created between aesthetic pleasure versus gastronomical pleasure. For if you eat all the food, the performance of the piece also ends. We interrupt your regularly scheduled program done with fellow artist Daniel Sauta. Here, the broadcast signal is compressed and re-seen as a horizontal landscape, kind of reflecting on the visual and aesthetic imagery that the television produces. Net worth, where it explores a new value system where individuals are asked to swipe their credit card only to have their name Googled, and the number of hits they get is sort of reflected back on that monolithic screen. The more hits you get, the higher up on the screen you are. Also begging the questions with people at the top, who's more important to our society, Paris Hilton or William Shakespeare? Con artists, here the very system of the credit card machine is used. This piece sort of comes out of post 9/11 economic situations where George Bush prompted the US population to go purchase in order to stimulate the US economy, but did not care what was being bought or sold, simply the fact that transactions happened. So here, at the point of sale, nothing is actually exchanged. There's no product or service given, though there is money taken. The only thing is my name will show up 30 days later on your monthly statement. Here, Philip K. Dick meets green practices as a robot sheep will cut your grass in front of this botanical garden. And seen where issues of labor, especially with the stigmatized undocumented worker, are then seen on an infrared LED screen, which is invisible to the naked eye and can only be seen through mobile devices, thus creating concerned publics out of passive crowds.
Thank you. My work moves between drawing, sculpture, installation, and print media. And in this project, Ideal Cities, drawings of storage sheds piled on top of each other, combined with cardboard cutouts made by a die-cut machine that fold up into the shape of a storage shed seen as if in perspective. These everyday objects of the self-storage facility, which dot the landscape in the United States and many other parts of the world, are generally overlooked. And in this work and in much of my other work, I seek to draw attention to the things which are overlooked. In this project lot, vinyl-cut weeds in silhouette are layered on windows and crawl out of the cracks between the floor and the wall in different gallery spaces. Sometimes the scale changes, but ultimately the viewer is asked to consider the function and nature of the gallery space as a white cube, as well as think about this idea of growth being overtaken by uncontrolled weeds. In this artist's book, A Field Guide to Weeds, a very simple structure through this 96-page book evolves as weeds grow out of the gutter of the book, evoking the way that a crack in a sidewalk will have weeds growing directly out of them. Over the course of the book, the weeds gradually take over the entire book. I also work in intaglio processes, working from photographic digital images to these very old technologies. And these kinds of forms, again, which are the generally overlooked images, become translated through representation, both in intaglio, drawing, and then are sometimes translated into installation pieces, such as this project, Holy Moly Land, where thousands of laser-cut pink styrofoam, industrial styrofoam pieces are cut out and then layered one on top of the next. In this piece, which you saw the image in the previous intaglio print, you have a simple empty billboard reduced to a two-dimensional surface. And even though it looks like it's a three-dimensional perspectival image, what you're actually looking at is a flat billboard that has been cut out with a CNC router and then put down on top of this Pittsburgh Center for the Arts Carolinian mansion. And the disjuncture between these things hopefully causes the viewer to maybe wonder if it's actually art, do a double take, realize it's flat, and then recognize that it's something other than what it seems to be. And finally, in this piece, Space Available, everyday signs from today's economy taken from photographs in New York City are redrawn as pastel drawings, exactly two scales, the original drawings, and then reinstalled in this empty storefront space. Again, calling into question the nature of what you're seeing, representation, and the materiality, asking the viewer to reconsider the everyday.
We'd like to continue by sort of talking about some of the stuff we were thinking about when it came to making this project. We'll start off by thinking about the site. The site was where it was initially installed was located in New York City. It was located in Long Island City, and the park that it was placed in faces Manhattan, the island of Manhattan. Particular to the piece, here's some details. On one side, you can see the park, but more interestingly, right next door, you can see where our door was located, and right next door is Costco. For those of you who don't know what Costco is, Costco is one of these big box consumer stores. And of course, in these sort of consumer castles, it makes sense to have permeable doorways as opposed to closed doorways because it just facilitates the need to shop.
And the ability to pile huge quantities of stuff on your cart so you can get in and out quickly.
And thinking about interactivity, and you know, the switch becomes the basic unit, let's say, of the interactive, and the door sort of precedes even the electronic switch. This is a piece by Duchamp, and I guess anytime we address the ready-made, Duchamp will come to mind. This is a project of his where the door oscillates between either opening a bathroom or his studio. Again, just something we were thinking about.
Something with our door that we were also thinking about, you know, again, in this idea of the switch, there's either the studio or the bathroom. There's an inside or an outside or two different insides. And we were thinking about the doorway as a permeable barrier, thinking about the idea of barriers, be it fences that are erected to keep borders separate or simply private properties separate. We were thinking about the ineffectiveness of a fence or a wall that was actually easily circumvented by walking around it or simply walking up to it and through it.
The next piece is, this is Tilted Arc by Richard Serra, which
created this kind of barrier, which was, you know, right, completely frustrating to the people who worked alongside this plaza and ended up being taken down because of its impermeable.
Right. Let's say Richard Serra would have worked well if he had an automatic door installed in this piece. Partly why we're showing Richard Serra and also now Dan Graham, as Andy alluded to, is minimalism and its effects. Minimalism sort of comes out of taking the formal aspects of industrial design, and for us it sort of became interesting to subvert that by reappropriating industrial formal qualities in the ready-made as a response to minimalist structure.
Here we have, you know, this Dan Graham piece in the middle of a park, and one of the things that we wanted to do was also play off this idea of the sculpture in the park, the idea of a public park, especially right next to this gigantic parking lot and the private space that is the huge Costco. And by situating our piece in the middle of a park, not unlike Dan Graham's piece or these images of Follies, we wanted to start to bring up the idea of landscape, public space, private space, and just have these things kind of entered into a general conversation.
So the architecture of Folly has its own tradition, primarily in the 19th century in London and France, where rich eccentrics would put up these reduced architectures that would sort of allude to landscape painting.
They would allow the person walking through the space to kind of create their own sense of a landscape painting, to create these points where they could reinterpret the actual landscape into kind of a composed image.
So, not to the project itself. We thought we'd share a short video.
There was this really funny play between this kid who kind of decided he was in charge of designating who got to go through the door or not. He became kind of the gatekeeper. It was kind of... One of the things we liked about this piece was that it functioned, just as Andy said, in some ways as a very simple supermarket door plunked down in the middle of a park. And on one level, that's all it is. But on another level, it's all these other things that, you know, we were thinking about. It's a threshold that doesn't actually lead anywhere.
Thank you. to another aspect, and you see it here with these kids running way from the end of the park, is the ability for this piece to sort of kind of lead people in a certain manner through the park, where they would, you know, be kind of succumbed or seduced into coming and walking through the doors.
And by recontextualizing this everyday door in a park like this, we suddenly drew attention to this everyday thing. These kids probably don't spend all that much time in a regular supermarket running in and out of the door. But because it was suddenly placed in this context, it had a little bit more the aspect of a spectacle.
But it also, you know, begs the question, right next door there is this Costco with five of these. And is it just the decontextualization of it that allows this to really change its behavior? I'll just go to them. The other aspect, and Kim alluded to this, that actually was not foreseen, was this notion of the neutered threshold. That unlike most spaces where you are talking about an in and out, a living room, a dining room, two spaces that are kind of differentiated by some sort of threshold, here one was going from the same space to the same. And the surprising sort of element to this was, as you went through, there was this level of disappointment. There was that perhaps that moment of Star Trek-ness or Stargate-ness where you might have been transported, and yet as you went through, this just feeling of disappointment that nothing actually transpired, which was actually kind of something unexpected in its sort of creation.
We also were really happy about the way the grass wore down around the piece, you know, again, as a kind of the residue of the interaction with the project, so that
right. Or a document, in a way, mm-hmm. of people's interactions in the park. Very minimal, no?
We played with the door for the opening. We had we had grand opening flags to welcome the door to the park. We decorated it at different times during the year. It actually was outside for 9 months, and we were really happy that it worked for 9 months without the motors dying or anything. This is one of the pastel signs that I showed you earlier, and I wanted to play with posting those here. And
we were trying to have a big sale, so all those other sculptures you could get for reduced prices. And then I know there's a sort of debate that this is just the, oh, it's just a supermarket door, you know, automatic sliding door, but we'd like to acknowledge the people who actually make the door. And to let you know, it did take a lot of technical prowess. Not done by us, of course, but full credit to companies like this. So we'll let this sort of play out. You can enjoy it. Thank you.
In awe of that video that you just showed at the end there. And my first question is about the handy adjustment by the operator. And how? No, I'm joking. I'm going to throw over, I just used up all the questions in the last session, so I mustn't do that again with this particular session. But I do want to ask you about the title, When Laughter Trips at the Threshold of the Divine. What's all that about?
Our response normally is, if you go through it 10,000 times, you'll come to realize it.
There's not much to add. I mean, basically, it's either just a door or it's when laughter trips at the threshold of the divine.
All right. I was disappointed that we didn't succeed in getting it over here, and I wanted to ask you about the practicalities of that, because it's in documentation in the OCAR Center, and one of the reasons why we judges actually award things is so that we can see them for real, so that was a big disappointment for me. I was thinking about the practicalities or the realities of doing that in Europe. Would we simply locate one locally, source one locally? And if so, are there regional cultural differences between supermarket doors?
We were also very disappointed that it wasn't possible to install it here. And I think it's because it's the year of culture in Linz that made the space so much less available. But we actually posed that very issue to the OCAR Center, that either, you know, we'd be happy to ship the extant door, or if it would be easier or less expensive, we would have been just as happy to have a European door. That really, it's the idea of door, automatic door, which was important.
And then, as far as the cultural, we've noticed some differences. The doors here seem to be a little thinner, even more so than the American counterpart. Very much like the people.
Like the people, yeah.
Like the
Sorry.
People.
Yeah. Don't want to steal your best lines. let's throw this open to the audience. Do we have any comments, questions? We have microphones.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if the door became a site for other artists to do work. So if upon seeing signs posted up there, other artists started posting signs, perhaps graffiti artists consider repurposing it, or if not, why you think people kind of let that space be separated from other art hacking?
Actually, not so much happened, probably due to the park itself. It's specially designated park for sculpture. It does get closed in the evenings. We were very open to it. Dogs took free license with it. And there was this one instance where it should grace some CD cover of some band that decided to pose in front of it. But I think, I mean, we were very open to anyone using it, but just because of the situation of the park.
And also, that park gets used for a lot of different things. There are theatrical productions, and actually there was at least one, was it The Wizard of Oz? There was the staging of something that happened pretty much around the door, so it actually became part of it. There was also a big gala event where the door was in the way, so that actually just kind of got kind of squeezed into the gala, but on the very corner, so that it was almost not functional anymore because you couldn't really move in or out of it. I did have one friend volunteer his interest in doing a performance as a window washer. And I don't think that was ever actually played out, but the proposal is pretty good.
I think we had a question over there. Sabine, I saw.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, my first question was going in the same direction. If the local public kind of used the door for putting stickers on, and you just explained what happened anyway. I was not 100% sure if this is a real permanent installation or if it has a time frame. You mentioned that it ran for 9 months now, and if it's really meant to stay there. And I have one comment. You said that it was about inclusion and exclusion. For me, it also has a strong resemblance the way it is placed there, with looking at Manhattan Island, that it's also about spaces of desire, spaces that we long for, which is also true to the shopping centers as well, where we have these products of desire. Maybe you could comment on that.
That's a really nice way that you put that. I mean, I think that's a really good point, because actually the real estate in Manhattan across the East River is really desirable in terms of its price compared to that in Queens. Yeah, I thought you actually made that
And I think maybe we didn't address it quite the same way, but we did frame it such, and with the same kind of consideration that there is the possibility of this virtual box behind these doors, and what happens when we decide to put something like this in a public park vis-a-vis next door, where the same structure delineates a sort of private property. So the illusions were definitely there. We were talking more in detail about once the threshold was passed, that it suddenly gets subverted, this idea of the inside and out. But from the distance, from outside, I think it plays the same role as before.
Yeah, you kind of fill in the space mentally where the building would be, but then the minute you pass through, there's no longer an inside or an outside. I mean, that's kind of the transformation. It was really nice to see people in that park and in that neighborhood embrace this thing. It wasn't, I remember the other part of your question now, it was not a permanent installation. It was commissioned as part of an emerging artist exhibition at Socrates Sculpture Park. So it was a 9-month exhibition, and we would love to find a place for it to go next. We would have loved for it to be here.
Thank you very much. We're going to move rapidly on because we're running out of time. We're going to hear from Jens Wunderling, Default to Public, the other honorary award of distinction in this year's Ars Electronica Interactive Arts Prize. Default to Public is one of those extraordinarily simple and powerful pieces which puts two things together and creates something much more than the sum of its parts. It's a suite of objects, softwares, and installations which bring Twitter into the real world, grounding Twitter within geographically specific locations. We were offered three pieces created by Jens. Tweet screen, in which tweets from the public timeline, which means an awful lot of tweets globally, are projected in a public space, but only if they originate within a very specific area. And that's a very, very interesting proposition. I was very, very excited when I saw that because it brings all kinds of ideas of community, of sociability, of neighborliness. No, you know what I mean. In a very, very simple but powerful way. Another piece is Status Panel, basically a doorbell with an embedded Twitter screen. Again, very cool, very simple, very powerful. So you can let people know your status before they decide to bother you or not. And then finally, we saw TweetLeak, a monolithic installation which aggregates tweets originating close by the monolith and prints them out on strips of adhesive paper, which anybody can take away and stick wherever they like. Again, a really interesting way to raise issues of locality and something which could work extremely well in the workplace, for example, and slap that onto Twitter.